Greet you all in Jesus' name this morning. I've enjoyed Sunday school with Rick and much Antioch seems a far away from Rick Barnett, but maybe it's not so different. It's good to be back here. Most of you knew we were in Canada for a few weeks. Actually, it wasn't as long as it seemed. It's just that it caught weekends at either end. And we drove up to Alberta for the two ordinations up there. And the first Sunday, we were in Manitoba with Brother Tim's parents. That was enjoyable. And then we were out in Alberta the rest of the time. And on our way home, we didn't quite make it back here in time for church last Sunday. So we decided to stop halfway in South Dakota and come the rest of the way Monday morning. Anyway, if you like to drive and drive and drive for a very long, uninteresting time, I invite you to drive to Alberta and see the brothers and sisters up there as well. And you're yearning for seeing wide open fields and space will be satisfied for a while probably. And but it was good. It was good to be there and see the churches firsthand, meet the families. There are about four groups up there. Three of them are officially pilgrim congregations. There's a fourth one that's trying to form. So in the very south, sort of south of Calgary, there's Grasslands, which is the southernmost church. And it's literally true. It's grasslands. That's what's there. Prairies with cattle on them. And then you go up about 2.5 more hours. You come to Stettler, which is sort of between Calgary and Edmonton. You go up another 4.5 hours. You come to Slave Lake, which is up more in logging country, up in the woods. And then you can drive another several hours. I forget how many hours on west to the Prairie Light Church, which is, if you've ever been up there, it's kind of in the direction of BC, like Fort St. John, BC, way up there. Way up there at the edge of civilization, literally, like where people live. Because if you go much further, you come to the Northwest Territories and the tundra and where no one is. So it was good to be there. It was a good experience because so many of the people up there were from backgrounds or social circles where I did not move in before, and we had nothing in common that, you know, that we could connect on. A lot of them are from the Low German speaking Russian Mennonite background and lived in the north or in Mexico or in places far away. And we'd meet and you do the, well, who are you and where are you from? And you try to establish some common connection and you strike out. No, your father, no, never heard. No, the church you were in before, nope, never heard of it, never heard of it. Your grandparents, nope, never heard of it. It's just like, okay, well, hi, we're a new friend. No connections and no acquaintances in common even. And so that was a good experience. I will say, the ones that aren't from Russian Mennonite background, pretty much all the rest up there are Torkelsons, it seems like. So I think Nancy and Kendra probably have a lot of distant connections up there. So, but it was good. And I was musing on the way home about the nature of how we make friends. And we met a lot of new people. Our children met a lot of new friends. And I was thinking about how unique that friendship thing is, and you meet new people, and then you make a connection, and you start building on that, and how that works, and how, or even how friendships you had in the past can be paused for many years. I had an experience one evening. I was there after the ordination. I was talking to a brother, middle-aged man. And a woman walked up to us there that I didn't know. I said, so is this your wife? Because I assumed that's why she was standing there. And yes, and I did all the polite things and shook hands and said hi and everything. And I turned back to the man to keep on talking. And she said, you don't remember me, do you? And I looked at her again like, oh, Yeah, she said, you were my teacher 30 years ago, music teacher in Pennsylvania. And I instantly recognized her then. So that was a little humbling. But I met another man in South Dakota that I was a Bible school friend and hadn't seen him since, 30 plus years. And yeah, it's amazing. You meet these people, and a few minutes, it's like 30 years didn't matter. You ever have that experience? It doesn't matter. You meet them again, and you keep on going. Well, turn to John 15 for a passage here. The title of my sermon this morning is Dying for My Friends. We're going to talk about friendship. Most of us want to have good friends, and we're going to talk about how to die for them. So John 15, verse 9. As the Father hath loved me, so have I loved you. Continue ye in my love. If ye keep my commandments, ye shall abide in my love, even as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. These things have I spoken unto you, that my joy might remain in you, that your joy might be full. This is my commandment, that ye love one another as I have loved you. Greater love hath no man than this. Read it together, the rest of it. That a man lay down his life for his friends. Ye are my friends, if you do whatsoever I command you. Henceforth I call you not servants. For the servant knoweth not what his Lord doeth, but I have called you friends. For all things that I have heard of my Father I have made known unto you. Ye have not chosen me, but I have chosen you, and ordained you that ye should go and bring forth fruit, that your fruit should remain, that whatsoever ye shall ask of the Father in my name, he may give it you. These things I command you, that ye love one another. Now, you can lay down your life for a stranger. Many have. When, in 2001, when the World Trade Center was struck and the Pentagon and so forth, some 440 some first responders, firemen, policemen, died rushing into burning buildings trying to save people's lives that they didn't know. Okay, that's laying down your life for a stranger. But Jesus said friends in this verse, and so we're going to focus on that. What does the Bible teach about deepening our friendships? I think it matters here at Ridgeview because a lot of you haven't been friends for very long, right? 5, 8 years maybe. You're still getting to know each other. And my interest is that I want you to think about this concept of a process, that we're not ready to die for a new friend that you made. You met somebody new, a new family. You're not ready to die for them until you and your new friend, have both allowed that relationship to deepen over time. And the process is reasonably similar for everyone, but not quite predictable. It's not like these little online computerized compatibility tests where you answer some questions and you decide if you and another person could be friends. It's not quite that predictable because it involves our spirits, and so it's often mysterious, and it's always kind of a miracle because we're made with God's image. And yet, we can become wiser in our friendships by observing how they are deepened. It's a slow living process. You know, it's not like, well, if you had two puzzle pieces and the one was shaped like this and the other one was shaped like this and they fit together, then you can be a friend with that person. And if the one little bump is a little different and the two puzzle pieces, you know how children sometimes, when they get desperate putting a puzzle together, just kind of push them, just make them fit because I want to get this puzzle done. And jigsaw puzzles, that has to be just right or it won't fit at all. Friendships are more mysterious than that. They're more spiritual and it's more of a miracle. It's not like a two train cars that come together with a satisfying mechanical clunk and then they're locked. And then a little later, we can just go latch with some air pressure and we can unlock them again, and now they're separate. And no, you know how friendships are. It's more like grafting trees, maybe, that when you get close enough to someone for long enough and the conditions are just right, you kind of grow together into connected living tissue that can only be separated again by cutting living tissue and by it hurting and by things tearing and so forth. That's how friendships are. It's not mechanical. So with this John passage in mind, we'll come back to it a little bit. I want to think a little bit about this process of how we deepen our friendships, here as a brotherhood or just friends you have. My first point is that we're born friendly, but not wise. So you watch little babies, they seem to be made for social interaction, right? They coo and smile, and they love when you look at them and play peekaboo with them and things like that. They love the interaction. They want to be friends with their brothers and sisters and so on. They respond very quickly. And yet, they don't seem to be prepared to be good friends. They don't come pre-wired with a knowledge of how to be a good friend, because you know how it is. They get to be toddlers and they're best friends with some new person. They're playing with toys and they're pushing trucks around, and the next moment they're applying the truck on the head of the other one, in frustration because something, Well, that's a very good way to compromise friendships. This is not the way to build. And yet little people don't know. They cut off their own friendships just like they do other foolish things. They put applesauce in their hair and things like that because they're not wise. And they have to learn. They have to learn gradually through life how we do friendship. All of us had to. My second point is that conversion, when we become Christians, it doesn't guarantee great friendships or having many friends. Well, should it? Well, there's one thing. Jesus said, if you follow me, what's going to happen? Some people are going to hate you. So you might lose some friendships if you follow Jesus. He said your family might hate you. The world might hate you. You might find some conflict. So there's that side of it. But it's true that if the Holy Spirit lives in your life, you will be what? Well, hopefully you'll be less selfish. If you're less selfish, are you more likely to have good friendships? Yes. And so from that standpoint, Christians should find it a little easier to sustain friendships in life. They should. When you're living an ungodly life, like Ephesians says, you used to be kind of a mess. Such were some of you. You walked like the children of wrath. Okay, you had temper problems. You had this and that. And, well, that makes you prickly people, and you have trouble being friends when you're not walking after Christ. So it's kind of true, and yet it's not automatic, because Jesus said it and said it and said it. The apostles repeated it and repeated it. Please, in the congregation, in the brotherhood, in your families, love one another. Be kindly affectioned. He says you have to work on this. It's not automatic. My third point is that through investment, friendship deepens by stages. I think I'll put a little chart on the board here to illustrate this, but it's popular in our time, and those of you who are my age or older know that it has shifted over time, that it's popular today to talk a lot about relationships. And few things are more indicting or more dark sounding than for someone to say, now John, he just has no relationship with his boys. That sounds terrible. Or we used to go to this church over there and the ministry just had no relationship with the members. That's just a mark of a lot of broken things. And so a lot of counseling today and so forth pushes the relationship thing toward the front, and we often say, well, that has to come first before truth can come, and lots of ink is spilled over which is more important, to be friendly or to tell the truth and so on. But the truth of it is that the way that, I'll just say it this way, I think we're a little careless with our terms, because a relationship is not an on or off switch that you have one or you don't have one. It's not quite like that. At least in my world, it's not. And you can tell me if you think it's like this for you. But I'd like to suggest that that you go from having none, I don't know this person, I don't do anything with them, to starting to have a relationship, you go through about four steps from zero to a very good relationship, someone you love and you would die for. It's a process you get to gradually.
Thank you for this verse. It was right in our text. Step one, when you meet, let's say you're in a dark parking lot in St. Louis about 1 o'clock in the morning and a stranger comes walking up to you like he wants to talk to you. Now, for most of us, the first thing that you're thinking about is this going to be safe? Is this person going to hurt me or not? What is he up to? I don't know him. I have no relationship with this person at all. And your mind goes into high gear about how I could get out of this if it turns out wrong. And he might call you and you might keep your distance a little bit. Well, that's maybe a more extreme scenario. What if it's just a person that's in the aisle at Walmart and you don't know them? They come up to you and they want to talk to you, and you're still doing a little bit of this, like, what? I don't know why you're coming to me here. And so it's interesting how societies have developed habits about how you approach a brand new relationship. One of you boys, schoolboys, tell me, what in our culture do two people do the first time they meet when they're complete strangers? What's the first thing they do? One of you boys back here. What do two strangers do? What's the first thing you do? Yes. Well, okay, you might get the name, but somewhere right in there, what's the thing you do, not a thing you say? Yes. You shake hands. That's a strange thing to do if you stop and think about it. I mean, you could do all kinds of things to the person, I suppose, but you reach out and you grab their hand and you move it back and forth a little bit or something. That's kind of an odd thing. Where did that ever come from? Well, I'll tell you. It's a social gesture that people have developed. I don't know how long ago that started, because in some cultures they don't. What is it? You know, I've heard of what Eskimos rub noses or do something else. You know, so I don't know. But around the world, and in some countries, maybe Asians, they have other bowing or things they do. But in our culture, we're used to shaking hands, and the development of this has to do with showing that I am not going to hurt you. I show you. I have no weapons in my hand, and I'm not making fists. My hand is open, and I will touch you. And we'll hold for a few seconds here. We're making a connection, and we're not hurting each other. Okay, so you have simple little steps like this. And now, we shake hands friendly. You know, that's not why we shake hands after church here, to see if you're going to hurt me. But this is what you're doing. When you meet a new person, your shields are up all the way to here, and you're peeking over the top, right? Your shields are in place. I don't know who you are. I don't know what you're going to do to me. And then you start talking to them, and your shield drops down a little bit, and you realize that, okay, I think they're okay. Now, in the Christian context here, at church, you meet a stranger. Some of you might be visitors here, and a brand new person might meet you. They know you're not going to hurt them, but they might still have their shields up because they don't know. Are you going to support me? Are you going to be a person that I end up liking or not? So there's some initial safety check that happens when you meet a person for the first time. This is step one of forming a relationship. And then we start talking, always. That comes next. We start talking. And so, and each step here becomes deeper. I'm just going to call this one discovery. Okay, so here's where you start talking, and what's your name, and where are you from, and who are you, and what do you do, and what do you like? And we just start chatting and we start talking. And in step two of forming a friendship, there's lots of conversation. You might laugh together. You might. But the goal is basically, do you like what I like? That's what you want to find out. What kind of person, what motivates you? What kind of, and you've had the experience, you meet a new person, and you start talking. Well, men, somewhere along the way, pretty early in the conversation, they want to find out what you do. What do you do? Oh. Or what do you like to do? Oh, you fish too. Are you work on diesels or something? I don't know. And you start building some connections there. You're discovering about that person. Now your connection's a little deeper. You might delight in it, or you might find them, they have a set of interests that you don't, but you discover about them, what motivates them. It can take a while. I would say that probably to some extent in a congregational context, when a new family moves in or you get to know new people, this takes a number of years to really learn about a family. Sometimes you meet a new person and it happens quickly, but it takes visiting and being in their home and working together and I don't know. You learn a lot about people when you go to their house and you see what's important to them. Like look at their desk maybe or something, or see what they spend money on. Like what's important around the house or the property. It's like, oh, they planted a lot of new trees here. Oh, they have a chicken coop out here and it's very well cared for. Or they. You know, whatever the things are around their house, where they're restoring an old tractor, or they're doing something that they enjoy, and you learn about them. Oh, maybe you have to learn about them through hardship, like you learn a lot about families and friends when something terrible happens, like a death, or a house burns down, or something. We learn. So that's step two. You discover, and then if that goes well. Like you get to know someone and you kind of like them. What happens next? How do you deepen a friendship after you kind of know about them? Well, if you meet a new person and you decide they're safe and they're enjoyable, very soon on the heels of that comes a desire to share with them. Hey, come to our house and eat some of my food. Or I have something you would like. You remind me of a person who would like this, and so you get gifts for them. You maybe give them gifts. You start exchanging your stuff because that's how we do. That's how we're made to do. We love to share. This reminds me of you. It's a token of affection and friendship. And that's good. Now it's deepening. Now we're friends. Now we're exchanging our stuff. We're not selfish. You can have my things, I have your things, and you wouldn't do this with random people necessarily, but you do it as you get to know somebody. And the fourth is still not the deepest step. The fourth step is dying. So, and this is now we're getting closer to what Jesus was talking about. You would die to save my life. And it's not the kind of heroic story where you rushed into a burning building or you leapt into the water at the edge of the waterfalls to save somebody's life and whatever, some dramatic story. It's more like dying a little bit a lot of times to your own wishes, your own will, because it works a little like this. All friends are going to be difficult for us at some moments. Or maybe your friends aren't that way. I think a lot of mine are. Where they all have moments where they're a little difficult. They didn't try to be, but they were a little selfish. They were a little whiny. They were a little bit buggy. They were a little bit something. That was just not pleasant. But they're my friend. And, hey, we love them anyway. We know they don't mean to hurt us. And we will absorb it. That's what dying for friends is. You absorb the thousand little ways that your friends aren't always thoughtful, but you love them because you have a lot of richness between you. There's a lot of trust, and so you're willing to die for them. That is so true in the congregation. That's how brotherhood works. Because think about it. What if it were missing? What if it were missing? What if we tried to be a brotherhood here And yeah, we shared our things, we were sort of friends and so forth, but we had no room to absorb the ouchies, no room to absorb the little bumps, none. Not ready to die for anything. Then you have trouble, and as you can imagine. And so the deepest level of friendships is the one Jesus said here, we lay down our life, we die for our friends, and we put up with the trouble. Well, those are the four steps. A few observations about that yet. You can tell that in order to deepen 1, 2, 3, 4, any direction to the next number down is another investment in risk, right? You make yourself vulnerable. If you don't, if you keep your shield all the way up high, you'll never move from 1 to 2 or 2 to 3 or 3 to 4. You won't get there. If you're like, nah, I don't trust this. No. So every step along the deepening is a lowering of your shields, putting away, taking a risk, and seeing if you could be friends with this person in a deep and lasting way. So it takes grace when we have experienced injury. If you've ever been betrayed by a friend or hurt deeply, it makes it harder to go from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4. We tend to, our shields get kind of stuck up pretty high, and we just say, nah, I'm not into this. And some people can go through life with their shields up high almost permanently, and it's a handicap. Because when you drop your shield and you start telling your friends what you like, you start telling them who you are, you start revealing your family secrets to them, you start showing them the inside of your heart and the inside of your diary, you start showing them all these things, you know what happens? Now they have a lot of handles to turn on you. They have a lot of ways to hurt you. They know a lot of embarrassing things about you. And they better be trustworthy with what you told them, or disaster happens. Lewis said, love anything and your heart will certainly be wrung, possibly broken. If you want to make sure of keeping your heart intact, you must give it to no one, not even to an animal. Wrap it carefully around with hobbies and little luxuries and avoid all relationships. Lock it up safe in a casket of your selfishness. But in that casket, safe, dark, motionless, airless, it will change. It will not be broken. Your heart will become unbreakable, impenetrable, irredeemable. So that's the worst kind of safety. Is to take no risks for friends. Well, let's look at some. I want to go to 1 Samuel 18. You can turn there a while, but I want to go back and answer this question yet of when people say, I have a relationship or I don't have a relationship. I would say it like this, is to not have a relationship means you never think about this person. You have nothing to do with them. Sometimes you get to step one or step two, and then it stalls. You ever have any of those friendships? You kind of met somebody. Maybe they were a coworker. Maybe they were somebody you go to church with for a few years, and that was fine. But it just never got deeper. Just never was, I don't know, we just didn't have much in common. Just didn't go for it. Maybe it could go. It's kind of pending. It's just there. It's not hostile. It's just not deepening. You know, he likes to go to flea markets and raise pigs, or I don't know what he likes to do, or what she likes to do. And I don't know. I'm just not interested in that. And when we get together, we struggle to find things to talk about for a whole hour because we just don't have much in common. That can happen. It's not hostile. It can happen between two Christians. A hostile relationship is one where there's been injury between the two, some kind of injury. But it's not no relationship. It's not even a broken relationship. Because hostility is one of the most powerful relationships there are. And people can be very strongly linked in their hostility with each other. And they can't let go. They're like, they can't even let go of each other. They're just thinking about the other person. They're very strongly attached to them. But they don't like them as adversarial.
Well, most young people are concerned sometimes, teenagers, how about it, about whether they have any real friends or whether their friends like them or whether somebody else seems to have more friends than I do. Seems like they know a lot of people. And this is a point of some agony when we're 14 or 17 or I don't know where it stops. Where does that stop? 50 or 80? Well, you're worried that nobody likes me. It seems like I don't have any friends, and these people over here have lots of friends. They always have people over at their house, and we're just a family that nobody likes. We're sensitive about those things. And all I would say about that is that, you know, some sociologists have done work on this, and they say that, well, you can't stand to have more than a certain amount of friends. You can't sustain more friendships than so much. Your heart or your head is only so full. It can only be filled with so many close relationships. A number that gets bandied about a lot is 150, that most people struggle to have room in their hearts for any kind of real connection with more than 150 people. Beyond that, it begins to be a sort of first name basis, and it's not, you can't trust more people than that deeply and be a deep friend with. I don't know if that's true or not. It's probably true that there's a limit. And then you probably discover in life that somewhere along the way, as you get older especially, that the number of level 4 relationships you have just really isn't several hundred, is it? It just isn't. It might be more like a dozen. And I mean this in a kind of deep way, like the person that you know always has your back and will never desert you, no matter what. Just a deep, close relationship. Maybe you'd have one like that with a brother or sister or this, you know. It's not that we have dozens and dozens of these, but just a few maybe. And sometimes we hear it said that, well, in the Christian brotherhood, we should all be deep and close friends because we are one in Christ. And it is true that we should be close in Christ, but it is not true that you can be close to everybody. And it's okay to feel that way, in my opinion. It's okay to say, well, there are these 6 or 8 or 10 or 20 brothers or sisters that I just enjoy being with, and I feel like I could trust them to see the inside of my closets or whatever, my mental closets and everything. I know they will never betray me. I just have a deep sense of trust in them. Maybe it'll be just a few, and maybe that's okay. But you can do something about that, of course, if the, like Proverbs says, you have to show yourself friendly to make that happen. Well, in 1 Samuel 18, we don't have time to read these whole stories, but I'll read a few verses here. 1 Samuel 18, this is David and Jonathan, of course, and you get this sense of deepness here. The soul of Jonathan was knit with the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. Verse 3, then Jonathan and David made a covenant because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was upon him and gave it to David and his garments, even to his sword and to his bow and his girdle. So they were exchanging things here. They were making promises. You read sometimes of soldiers in battle who will promise each other that if I get killed first and you survive, well, I want you to have all my stuff and take care of my mother or something like that. That's the kind of relationship you see here. They so implicitly trusted each other that they were ready to make deep and lasting promises. And my, were they ever tested for David and Jonathan? Why, you know what happens in the very next chapter here? Jonathan's dad, Saul, was trying to get Jonathan to be involved in killing David, trying to get rid of him. And then he became a son-in-law, and still the murder attempts were continued. And this is now he's a brother-in-law, and his dad is half insane. And I mean, the situation was really tested, really tested. And yet, you meet them a few chapters later out in the field, and David and Jonathan, nothing has affected their depth of their friendship. They are committed to each other. And that's a blessing. I want you to turn to Philippians. Actually, I want you to turn to Ephesians, rather. Ephesians 4, verse 11. Our relationships are deepened by letting God's love flow through us. That is true. Through gracious words, through humility, through the role of a servant, like he talks about in Philippians. But they're deepened. Ephesians 4:11. I want to read a few verses here. Truth must carry every stage of a deepening friendship. And he gave some apostles and some prophets and some evangelists and pastors and teachers for the perfecting of the saints, for the work of the ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ, till we all come in the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God unto a perfect man, unto the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ, that we henceforth be no more children, tossed to and fro and carried about with every wind of doctrine by the sleight of men and cunning craftiness whereby they lie in wait to deceive, but speaking the truth in love, may grow up into him in all things, which is the head, even Christ. And I want you to jump down to verse 25. Wherefore, putting away lying, speak every man truth with his neighbor, for we are members one of another. Be angry and sin not, lest the sun go down upon your wrath, neither give place to the devil. Let him that stole steal no more. Rather, let him labor, working with his hand the thing which is good, that he may have to give to him that needeth. Let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth, but that which is good to the use of edifying, that it may minister grace unto the hearers, grace unto your friends. 31. Let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice, and be ye kind one to another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another, even as God for Christ's sake hath forgiven you. And so, truth has to carry every stage of a friendship. Wherever a friendship is trying to go from 1 to 2 or 2 to 3 or 3 to 4, wherever dishonesty gets injected into there, it's going to be torpedoed every time. The friendship will not go deeper. Just imagine this. I think all of you have lived in Missouri long enough to know that it's not uncommon to meet somebody, a complete stranger on the job and the workplace, and you're talking for about 3 to 5 minutes, and you're already detecting that not everything is true they're saying. How many of you have experienced that? It's just starting to come through, like, wait a minute, this is nonsense. I don't believe what he or she is saying. And so, right there, the possibility of you becoming a deep, lasting friend with that person is on the rocks already, because I don't know. They don't seem to be telling me the truth, so I'm not sure if I should drop my shield very much further here. So truth carries a relationship deeper every time. He says, speak the truth in love. Think about it like this. If a friend that you're getting to know speaks the truth to you, they're paying you a compliment. Because what do enemies do? Enemies lie to you. Enemies lie to you, and then as soon as your back is turned, they'll stab you. That's what enemies do. So they'll tell you to your face, oh, this is wonderful, wonderful. As soon as you turn around, they'll stab you. They'll say something slanderous about you. That's why Proverbs says, faithful are the wounds of a friend. Let the righteous smite me, and it shall be an excellent oil. It's the idea that real friendship only deepens when both parties can tell each other the truth. If you can't stand the truth, you can never be friends with that person. If you can't stand the telling of truth between you, what does that mean? What involves showing who I am? What am I like? Revealing the truth about my life, my troubles, my temptations, my problems. And really, sometimes the friendship goes deeper faster because you quickly see this person is just telling me everything that's in his heart. I mean, he's not hiding anything. It doesn't seem like it. She's telling me exactly what she thinks. And so you quickly start trusting them more because, well, it doesn't seem like they're trying to put a nice front up or something. And so truth has to carry it. The truth is, love and truth are not opposites. The truth is, we have differing abilities. He talks about the roles in the brotherhood. The truth is we are at different levels of maturity. It says that, you know, other places. Some of you were this and that, and now you're washed. And so you're never going to find a friend that's just right. They're mature, they're wise, they're witty, they're friendly, they're sympathetic, they are generous, they are all the right things. They make us feel good, they seem to be popular, we benefit from being around them. No, all of us are a little spottier than that. And quarreling and competition and comparing ourselves comes quite naturally, as he says here. So don't do that. Put on the new man. Speak the truth. Put away clamor and evil speaking. And grow into deeper friendship. An enemy would let you do your own thing. An enemy would watch you getting nearer to the edge of the cliff and say nothing. And a friend would say, hey, don't do that. You're in danger. What you're doing right here is not good. It's not safe. And this is hard for us to get through when we're 16 and 17. Even if you think you don't like what your friends are doing, you'd have a very hard time telling them, I think that's unsafe, what you're trying to do. You shouldn't do that. Because we're afraid that maybe they won't like us if we talk like that. But just remember that. An enemy will let you walk over the cliff, but a friend will stop you and say, hey, I'm your friend. I don't want to see you get hurt there. You shouldn't do that. Come back from the edge is what real friends do. Well, in conclusion, we already have a perfect friend who has passed all four tests here behind me. He's completely safe and kind. He's a source of endless delight to discover. Taste and see that the Lord is good. He shares more abundantly than any earthly friend. And he has literally died for you already so that you might live. And that's why Jesus says, I have not called you servants, I have called you my friends. Partly because he knew that we needed a perfect friend, and I think just partly in a very practical way, he wanted to be a role model for us. How do you have more friends and better friends here at Ridgeview, at work, at wherever? Well, to do these four things, to live like Jesus, and to extend vulnerability, to extend, to drop your shields, to love people. And my interest is that maybe some of us are new to each other here at this church. So we can drop our shields. We can go from 1, 2, 3, and 4 because it's possible. It's possible by God's grace. And as we do that, we all are enriched for it. Let's pray.